We Have Issues is a weekly podcast full of reviews of comics and oversharing. We use grown-up language to make very childish jokes. You can find the show at wehaveissues.net, as well as anywhere else where average to not too bad podcasts can be found. Hello listener, Nick here. I'm trying to remember how we normally start these. Doing things slightly differently this week. It's only me in the studio, so obviously the whole conversational start thing we normally do can't work if it's just me. I know there are people who think I probably could hold a conversation with myself, but I'm not one of them. Famously, solo recordings with just me involved go really badly. Which is probably just as well, because if I could do these sorts of things on my own, I'd probably have a YouTube channel that I was vlogging to at least once a day, and it'd just be a nightmare for everyone involved. Anyway, so this is We Have Issues 25. We're recording slightly differently because just events have conspired. Get well soon, Scarlett. That's why James isn't here. So events conspired to keep us all apart today. So I'm recording this at lunchtime. James and Jesse are not in the studio. Another thing I'm trying, which is slightly different, because there aren't other people here with me, I'm naked. I'm not naked. And even if I was, it wouldn't be the first time I was recording a podcast of James naked. Anyway, but I am standing up. I'm seeing how it works. It's supposed to free up the diaphragm and allow one to project a little bit more. Clearly, anyone who's listened to the podcast before will know that projection is a bit of a problem for me. I'm a very quietly spoken person. So we're seeing how that works. I feel very weird standing up, looking at two empty chairs across the way from me. It's a slightly weird experience, but we'll see how it goes. So what do we normally talk about? Talk about how our weeks went. I can't really remember how my week went. I'm very tired at the moment for some reason. I'm not sure what that's all about. I am struggling with public transport, having to use public transport again, getting used to all of the weird little things about public transport that I've been able to forget over the last few years. There are a couple of things. I guess the first thing is working out your routes. That can be difficult. Another thing is, if you're lucky, the thing I've realized, especially over the last 2 days, especially bearing in mind that this is summer, especially over the last few days, especially bearing in mind we're edging into summer, is that if sometimes buses smell. I know every stand-up comedian who's ever done stuff about public transport mentions this. Sometimes public transport smells. Sometimes there are drunk people or slightly odd or scary people on them. I've come to realize that those are the times when you're lucky, because if you have my particular temperament, the other problem with public transport is if you're lucky, the other people on the bus make you want to just close your eyes or look down and read something and look as far away from everyone else as possible. But they're also a really fertile place to pick up these micro crushes that I'm slightly prone to. If you're stuck at a bus stop waiting and there happens to be someone who's a little bit cute, that can be difficult. And if they then happen to be on the same bus as you, that's extra difficult. So that's been happening a lot, and we are edging into summer, which means that any walk through town ends up with thousands of these little micro crushes, which aren't that healthy for me. I get very distracted, not to the point where I walk into things or get run over or anything, but it can be a little bit weird. I'm so grateful to my wife for many different reasons, among which are the fact that she's absolutely amazing and very patient with me. But one of them is that I don't have to think about those micro crushes anymore. I can just have them and not worry too much about them, not worry that maybe I'm avoiding a meet cute or I'm being a bit like weird and desperate, because I can just absorb them into my day. But they do come thick and fast on public transport. I manage to avoid them the rest of the time. So anyway, that's literally all I remember about this week. Oh, no. No, it isn't. The other thing about buses. This morning, I was listening to a podcast. I was actually listening to Mark Maron talking to Rose Byrne. That was lovely. And I had my earphones in, my little earbuds, and I could hear this music, and I thought it was happening on the bus, so I took my earplugs out, couldn't hear it quite as well for some reason, so I put my earbuds back in and thought, has Mark Maron started using backing tracks for his music? This is weird. And I was on the bus for about 20 minutes. I was at the bus stop for about 5 minutes wondering about this, then on the bus for about 20 minutes, then I walked all the way into work. And it wasn't until I was in a corridor at work that I realized that I've got a tablet that I got from work, and I mainly use it to read comics and play games. I recently installed Candy Crush, one of the Candy Crush games, on there. And somehow I had switched on Candy Crush, and it was playing at top volume in my bag that I take to work, that I'd had with me on the bus, and I'd had with me at the bus stop, and I'd had with me walking down the street. Totally oblivious to the fact that I was bursting out all of this music. So if you were on a bus with me this morning, or just saw a little hairy, chubby guy walk past you, completely oblivious to the fact that he was blurting out this really weird, flowery, excitable music, that was me. I'm very sorry about that. Anyway, so this is We Have Issues. I will be talking about comics in a minute, and other people will be talking to you about comics. In this episode, you'll get the second installment of Maxi Barnard and the History of Manga. The first one was great. The second one is also great. We've also got the second installment of Peter Hamson's Epic Library Quest. He's given himself quite an obsessive task of reading all of the comics in his local library. So that should be interesting and nerve-wracking. And I'll be talking about a few of this week's comics as well. So all that's coming up. If you want to talk to us or me or anyone, me or us or anyone involved with the show about anything we talk about on here, if you've got any comic recommendations or things you think we don't talk about but we should, you can contact us at issuespod@gmail.com. You can also talk to We Have Issues on Twitter at issuespod. You can talk to me at nixsight, nixsight. You can also subscribe to us at your podcatcher of choice. A lot of people use iTunes. Apparently Apple have quite a good podcasting app. I use Pocket Casts for preference. There's also Stitcher. If you do like us, please do tell people about us. You can also obviously rate and review us at your podcatcher of choice. Oh, and there's a Facebook page. Tell you what, I think I'm going to let Max talk to you now, and I'll be back straight afterwards to talk some more in this weird bubble where it's just me and I'm talking into space.
Hello, monkeys. Wait, no, you're not. Fuck, you're not monkeys anymore, are you? I'm sorry. What are you? You issuers? We havers? I don't think there's a good term for you. Anyway, yes, it's Maxi B. I'm back after a short gap in my history of manga because I wanted to make sure I had some actual facts right, which means that this is a shorter section than previously planned, but it's going to bring us from where we left off last time, talking about ukiyo-e and shunga, and will take us straight up to the last relevant point before post-World War II, which is kind of going to be where everything starts shrinking on the timescale a bit. I mean, it's very much in a sort of terms where these early days, they're not relevant enough to not want to go pass over more than a little bit. So I'm just leading it with a bit of a preamble, as I tend to. It's also technically the end of what will be episode one of the collected version of this, The History of Manga. So as it goes, this will be collected after some rewrites and edits in the near future on its own separate MP3 for those who are interested. And then it will have the second part begin with us talking about World War II and some very important creators of that time, such as Osamu Tezuka and Machiko Hasegawa, who will continue to be two of the most important names you will hear over this entire series. That said, we're going to actually go in now and talk about one of the most relevant pre-manga creators, and that will be Katsushika Hokusai. So yes, let's talk about Katsushika Hokusai, as he's probably the most relevant creator of ukiyo-e art and shunga to this history of Japanese comics. He's primarily known for his frankly phenomenal series, 36 Views of Mount Fuji, and more so for one particular print from the bunch, The Great Wave of Kamigawa, which, look, just on the most basic level, it's a genius creation. It's this perfect woodblock print that uses negative space and a sort of symmetry, I suppose. The way I always like to describe it is there's a giant wave that takes up a certain amount of space, and then there's all the negative space. But if you turn it over, the negative space itself is its own wave, which I'm not a person well inclined to describing art correctly, but it's a sort of picture that inspires awe within me, especially for the era. The whole 36 are quite fantastic, to be honest. I think it's actually 46. There were like 10 extras, which, you know, that's cheating. And they all depict different scenes, with the only common thread being the presence of the legendary Mount Fuji, Japan's greatest landmark, and something that Hokusai himself felt a great love for. This is the work that most people know him for, all over the world, and it's really no surprise that that's the case. But that's not really the relevant part of the man's career to the development of comics in Japan. No, that comes from his sketch collections, the Hokusai manga. Being referred to as manga is highly, highly relevant. And there's lines to draw here, but what's more notable than anything is how it differentiates from that description of modern manga I gave at the very start of this series. For one, and really on the biggest level, this isn't actually a storytelling creation. No, rather this is very much a mass-produced sketch collection, each page being a work on its own, making the whole thing seem more like a smaller promotional collection of his art, something much more affordable and portable than the actual prints themselves, small as they themselves could actually be. Still, there is something here. The idea of art collected in small volumes in long series, in this case something along the line of 15 volumes depending on who you ask, and the fact that a huge amount of the work is surrounded by these thick panel lines, along with, you know, the legacy that ukiyo-e and Hokusai's art in particular has had on manga as a whole, well, simply put, you can't ignore the relevance of Hokusai manga, even if it itself is not actually anything like what we'd describe as contemporary manga. Actually, the work of Hokusai manga takes us up to Hokusai's death in 1849, and slightly beyond that, as the three slightly more dubious posthumous volumes came out all the way up through to 1878, which is where our pre-World War II history ends. There are works between 1878 and the 1945 occupation that have some smaller relevance, but the backdrop is set for that final leap, that movement of art towards sequential storytelling, and all that stands in the way is that need for Western exposure, however gross the means of this happening is. But then, what is art without tragedy, and what is war if not one of the most unpleasant tragedies of all? He says, like the fancy arsehole that he is. Join me next time as we talk the world's most horrific conflict and the art form that was born out of it. See, I told you it was quite short. To be honest, I expected it to take up a bit more room. Still interesting, relevant, bye.
Okay, so one of the ways that we're different from a lot of comic-y podcasts is that, as a general rule, we don't talk about comic scuttlebutt news and gossip and stuff like that. Part of that is a personal preference thing. I find it frustrating. And most of the time when I talk about new comic news online with people, I can be annoying. And I think it's a kind of an unfortunate thing for someone in my position, certainly, that I tend to find fandom annoying and geekiness annoying. There was a recent debate on a Facebook comic community that I'm on, where someone was deliberating over whether it's politically correct. That's really annoying, isn't it? Whether it's politically correct to use the term fanboy or fangirl. And someone asked, well, which is the right thing to say? And I was like, well, just fan. Fan works. What's wrong with the word fan? It doesn't have to be a part of your identity. Anyway, that isn't why we don't cover up-to-date comic news, unless it's something that really, really catches us emotionally. Part of it is that we're just not that organized. And part of it is that there's so much of it happening all the time that... and some of it, it seems important for 12 hours on the internet, and then it stops being important, that we'd just never be able to cover all of it, and it'd just be ridiculous. In the last 12 hours, probably last 24 hours, actually, time's weird, just on Twitter, me spending a bit too much time late at night on Twitter, there were a bunch of things that seemed really important. There's a Marvel playing fast and loose with the nature-nurture debate and how it relates to sexuality. Oh, and here's the other thing, the other reason we don't do it. Around 70 or 80% of coverage of stuff that's going on in comics is hugely spoilery and hugely detracts from the reading experience as far as I'm concerned. I was reading up on some stuff that's happening over at Marvel at the moment with one of their characters being written, it being revealed that they are gay. And every single piece of coverage of it had whole pages from this relatively new comic just telling you exactly what happens in them. But most of the time there wasn't even any warning that you were going to see actually how the story plays out. I think it's possible to discuss things in text without spoiling major story beats or anything like that. It's really difficult to do it in conversation on a podcast. Also, just in the last 12 hours, I think one creator who I really respect really called out another creator, and it's difficult to know whether anything is going to come of that. The nearest thing I can think of to it was Brandon Graham's tweets a couple of years ago about Brian Wood. It might come to nothing, it might not, but it seems very important at the moment you're reading it. Another thing that's happened was a whole bunch of independent creators, I guess other writers as well, but it was all comic-y people that I was following who were talking about it. And this is very UK-centric. They got very frustrated and annoyed very vocally about a piece of policy or a piece of writing in a Green Party document that suggests that they are going to do stuff with copyright that isn't going to help independent creators. It turns out that the Labour Party might have been the ones who started tweeting about that in the first place. Obviously, the Labour Party might have their reasons for drawing attention to stuff in the Green Party manifestos that they don't like. And again, it's something that seems really important right now, but I suspect that once questions get asked or once things actually play out, it might turn out not to be. So covering news in comics is just, unless you're really, really good at it or you're really, really diligent at it, it can be a little bit weird, and we're only barely any good at reviewing comics, so covering news just, it is a bit of a nightmare, really. So that's why we don't do that. Not that anyone asked, it's just obviously it seems that I feel insecure about the fact that we don't cover comics. This is an interesting thing to be learning when stuck in a room by yourself. So what did I read this week? Okay, first up, 2000 AD. The Central Dread story in 2000 AD at the moment is lovely. The Orlok story is okay. The Slain story is the Slain story. And Grey Area, as with most Grey Area strips, this one's written by Dan Abnett and Mark Harrison, as with most Grey Area strips, it's really hard to know what to make of it until it all plays out. Mark Harrison's art is really, really nice at the moment. Lots of nudity in this issue as well, though. Lots of female nudity. That's 2000 AD, Prog 1927. It's £2.45, and it's still pretty good value for money. But obviously, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that I fall in and out of love with 2000 AD. On balance, it's definitely worth picking up as a weekly comic. But I don't know. If you can get hold of the last two or three, it's worth picking them up, seeing if you like it, because all of the stories right now started two or three weeks ago. So what else? There's a new book written by Chip Zdarsky coming out from Image, the first issue of which was $3.50, so I guess it's not coming out at the $2.99 price point that a lot of Image books do, a lot of first issue Image books do at the moment. It's written by Chip Zdarsky with art by Kagan McLeod, and it's called Captara. It's not like other Chip Zdarsky books. It doesn't seem, I say other Chip Zdarsky books, but really I just mean Howard the Duck, because he's the artist on Sex Criminals. In that it's not a quite tight, detailed, very funny joke machine. It's a much looser sort of space opera story. It's called Captara. It's got art by Kagan McLeod and colours by colour assist by Becca Kinsey. And it follows the crew of a spaceship called the Kanga, who are like a contemporary Earth crew. I guess they're supposed to be a little way in the future because we don't have the technology they have, but and they're on a mission to Mars. But there are lots of pop culture references in it, like our modern pop culture references in it. So the story follows this crew at the beginning. They don't necessarily get on. They're quite a motley crew. The guy we seem to be focusing on the most at this point is called Keith. He's a pretty spoiled, spoiled and not that serious character who's it's revealed he's gay in this story, but it doesn't really seem that relevant to what's going on at this point, although he is I guess he teases the other characters quite a lot about it. But they're on this mission that seems all by the numbers up to a point, and then suddenly around the middle it shifts into what I really perceive as more of a Flash Gordon space opera feel, a sort of a fish out of water story of this Earthling who suddenly finds himself in this space fantasy story. There are stakes. Characters die in this first issue, and when it happens, it's kind of tonally odd, because up to that point it's been quite a light and almost silly read. I'm not sure about this. I quite like the way it's presented, but Chip Zdarsky's sense of humour is a funny book, but it isn't as front and centre, and it's not entirely sure what he's trying to do. If he's trying to make these characters who are more normal and naturalistic but happen to still make jokes, or what exactly is going on. It's almost too silly to be that realistic. And the art sometimes is great. I love the facial expressions in it, but sometimes the line and the tones and color of it all seem quite muted and a little bit flattened. So on balance, I think I really enjoyed it. It's interesting to see these different takes on that sort of Flash Gordon space opera, space fantasy story. There was Starlight last year, and there's this now, which is very different from Starlight, but has things in common. It didn't amaze me, but I did quite like it. It's definitely going to be worth leafing through. I think that Kagan McLeod's art is something that is really going to work for some people. It just left me a little bit nonplussed. I like more definitive lines and stuff like that. So, also, second issue of Invisible Republic, still $2.99 from Image. It's written by written and drawn by Gabriella Hardman, and co-written with Karina Bechko. Colors by Jordan Boyd. This is also science fiction, but I talked about the first issue a few weeks ago. Actually, it's a much more serious. It's kind of political science fiction. It's set on a colony of Earth where we sent out these generation ships because space travel was much slower. So we sent out this ship with a whole bunch of people living through generations on it to get to this planet. And by the time they got there, the human race had developed much faster space travel. And so all of the rich people from Earth turned up a little while after they'd set up this colony. And there's a lot of political conflict and stuff like that going on. And into that, what we see is a journalist, a pretty reviled journalist, actually, trying to piece together the story of a sort of a Che Guevara-esque political figure who, like a rebellious political figure who I think now might be a dictator. There are people who don't want the journalist to cover the story. The story is broken up between the journalist trying to uncover the story and the actual an actual flashback to the story itself as seen through the eyes of the female protagonist, Maya Reveron, who has kind of been removed from history, but it seems like she might have been quite close to it. It's really intriguing. It's quite a serious and down-the-line story. Gabriel, the writing's really good, but workmanlike. But Gabriel Hardman's art is just amazing. It's, again, very muted tones that really work for this story because it's a pretty grim planet this is all playing out on, a bit of a police state, really. And the line work is really scratchy and lovely, but it's all very realistic. The characters are all very realistically drawn. Finally, don't know what that was about. Finally, the first issue of the Thrilling Adventure Hour Presents Beyond Belief came out from Image this week. It's $3.50. It's written by Ben Acker and Ben Blacker, who apparently aren't related, even though their first names are both Ben. Apparently those names aren't made up either, even though they rhyme, which is pretty cool. With pencil art and cover by Phil Hester and ink art by Eric Gapster with Andy Parks. This is the second book to spin out of the podcast radio show, The Thrilling Adventure Hour. If you haven't listened to it before, James actually talked about the first book a few weeks ago, which was Sparks Nevada, Marshall on Mars. If you haven't listened to it before, The Thrilling Adventure Hour is tagged as being a new podcast in the style of old-time radio, and it's basically these little radio plays. Little radio play sounds really condescending, actually. It's radio plays featuring recurring characters performed in front of an audience in a theatre. And it's everything's very quirky and very fun. And the characters are very strong. And the writing is sort of note. The writing and performances are note perfect to that sort of sassy 1940s style radio drama thing that we probably are mainly familiar with now from little bits of it in period dramas that you might see. There was something similar in the series Agent Carter. There was a thread throughout that which was a radio play about Captain America. But obviously the whole thing is shot through with very contemporary and wry jokes. So yes, Beyond Belief is a series of these radio plays featuring the characters Frank and Sadie Doyle, who are the toast of the upper crust, headliners on the society pages, and oh yes, they see ghosts. So Frank and Sadie Doyle are Acker and Blacker's way of pastiching sort of Twilight Zone style stories. It's a little bit unusual because in the podcast, they're clearly set in the 40s or 50s. Sadie is sort of, you get a sense of Sadie being quite a socialite, and well, they're both socialites and flappers. In the comic, that falls apart a little bit because there are lots of contemporary things in the art. So anyway, Frank and Sadie Doyle are these great characters. They are quite cartoonish characters, but they are very much in love with each other and with booze. They're clearly sort of barely functioning alcoholics who don't really like to leave the apartment. They only really like spending time with each other, but they keep getting pulled into these supernatural stories, and that's what happens in this. They have a friend who's moving into a house in the suburbs, and they end up being pulled into her haunted house story. And the story plays out in a pretty fun sort of a way. It's all very light. Frank and Sadie are slightly more competent as in the podcast when they solve situations and ghost stories that come to them. Obviously, because it's an audio setting, everything tends to get resolved through clever double talk and convincing ghosts that they should be doing such and such. Whereas this is much more action oriented, as you'd expect from a comic, which is a much more visual medium. Acker and Blacker write these characters, so the voices are pretty much spot on from what you'd expect in the show. And Phil Hester's art is just gorgeous. He's got a very cartoony style, so likenesses are never really an issue. I'll get to likenesses in a second because it sounds ridiculous when you're talking about audio characters. Likenesses are never really an issue, but there's... His art is very bold and cartoony, but there's a real sense of place to everything. When there are ghosts in there, they're very when there are ghosts or supernatural creatures in there, they're very over the top and actually quite spooky sometimes. But you can tell all of the action plays out quite nicely. But you can just quite happily read his characters talking to each other on a page. It's never boring. There's a dynamism to it that's really, really nice. Colors are very bold in this as well, which helps too. It is weird though. I think for someone just reading the comic who isn't familiar with the podcast, this is probably a really good comic. It's quite unusual because it's an adapted work. It will seem to come out of nowhere. The idea of these two socialites reluctantly solving all of these supernatural problems, it kind of comes out of nowhere without the background, but it probably works fine. The problem for me is that although the writers created the characters, along with Sparks Nevada, these, well, actually probably more than Sparks Nevada, who's the other breakout character from the Thrilling Adventure Hour, these characters are so closely associated in my mind with the actors who play them, Paul F. Tompkins and Padgett Brewster, who bring so much to the characterization of them, that it's just weird seeing their words come out any other way than into my ears from those actors' voices. You'd think that wouldn't be the case because actually when you're reading a comic, the voice is the one thing that you're really having to work on as a reader. You know, sometimes that's the most, you don't really understand what characters sound like. And in this case, I've been told what they sound like. I know what they sound like because I've heard them. But weirdly, my imagination isn't as good an actor as those characters' voices are. And because they're doing radio, because they're doing a sort of a radio audio thing rather than being on TV where you can see them visually acting, obviously they're acting in a much more vocally exaggerated way, so it even more relies on the voice. So for me, it was a bit of a weird experience. I am definitely going to buy some more issues of this, though, because I do love Phil Hester's art, and it is really nice seeing these characters. But it felt a bit like my brain was cheating on Padgett Brewster and Paul F. Tompkins. There is an excellent sound effect that relates to the actors, though, at one point, which is bit of a weird thing to say. You'll spot it if you read it. There's also included, there's an origin story included in the back that came out, I think it came out as a digital comic a little while ago online. So it's quite a nice little package for $3.50. It's well worth it. But might be a bit odd if you're used to the characters already. So anyway, that's what I read. I think you should listen to Peter talking about library comics.
Hi, my name's Peter Hammerson, and you're listening to my epic library quest. Book 2, Torpedo 1936. Now, Gorytown Library was able to provide me with three volumes of the Spanish dark crime comedy Torpedo 1936. Now, this is written by Enrique Sanchez Abuli, with a little bit of art in Volume 1 by Alex Toth, and the rest of the art provided by Jordi Bernay. I actually got hold of Volumes 1, Volume 5, and Volume 6. Now, the short stories therein follow the pretty horrid hired killer, nicknamed Torpedo, through a variety of blackly comic adventures. This is all set in, or around at least, 1936. So it's American gangsters, mobsters, there's lots of violence. Most of the stories are about murder, killing, death, more killing, some murder. There's a few beatings, murder. I cautiously recommend Torpedo 1936, but I would say be wary, it gets very dark. I reached my limit in Volume 6 when a very unpleasant scene was turned into an extended joke. I would say it's worth a borrow, though, but if only for the excellent art.
Okay, I just want to talk really quickly about a comic that I just finished reading digitally. I got the first issue of it months and months ago when it came out, but had missed the rest because I just missed them at our local comic shop. It's an IDW title, so they get a few issues in, but if you don't catch it the week it comes out, I'll tend to just forget. So, and I picked them up on Comixology and read them all, and it's great. It's called Wild Blue Yonder. As I said, it's coming out from ID. It came out from IDW. I'm pretty sure it's available in trade, but if not, you can. If it's not, you can definitely pick it up on Comixology. It's the story is by Austin Harrison, Zach Howard, and Mike Raitt. The script is Mike Raitt, and the art is by Zach Howard with colors by Nelson Daniel. These are artists that I really associate with IDW. I think one of the first books I read from IDW was The Cape, and they were definitely involved in that, and together they have this really bold art style that's very clear and with really solid lines, and this really nice, they've taken that tone thing that happens with old comics, you know, the dots, I don't even know what you'd call them, but they've taken that and they've made it a real feature of their art. I guess they're adding all of that using computers. But they've made it a completely different thing from how it was used in comics originally. So, and that's kind of become a look that a lot of artists use now. So, but I think it might have started with Zach Howard and Nelson Daniel. I'm probably completely wrong about that. Anyway, Wild Blue Yonder was a 6-part series set in the sky. It's set in a sort of an environmental post-apocalypse where we've knackered the surface of our planet, so only people who are mining for energy, like for fuel, remain on the surface, and everyone else has gone and lives in airships in the sky. The main cast and crew are on a ship called the Dawn, which is the one sustainable airship that kind of has achieved a mythical status in this world as being the one ship that flies using the power of like solar power. That doesn't need to refuel. And the enemy protagonist in this is a guy called the Judge, who commands this ragtag fleet who are attempting to track down and steal the Dawn. In a lot of stories, him and his bunch would be the heroes, because they're kind of... In most narratives, they'd be the plucky underdog, really. But not in this one, because he's a brutal sack of shit, basically. I'm not gonna talk too much about it. It's just really worth reading. But it's kind of across the six stories, across the six issues, it plays out like an action movie. Really, there's not any really super deep characterization. There's not loads of soap opera going on, but you're introduced to quite a small cast of main characters who you almost entirely learn about through their actions. And very brief interactions with each other. There is romance, there is betrayal, there is mistrust, and people with secrets, and people with secrets that turn out to not be the secrets that you thought they were, and stuff like that. But mainly, it's an excuse for these really impressive action set pieces. As I said, it's all set in the sky. The technology, although it's quite far fetched, all feels very real. Partly because of how it's written, but also because the way Howard and Daniel draw it is very grounding. It's not realistic, but has a weight to it, which is great. And although it's clearly set in a future where these giant airships are possible, the technology all looks really lived in and great. It's just this really solid feeling action science fiction story. In my attempts to sort of pass it out in my head, I think it feels like a mix between Laputa, the Ghibli films Laputa and Nausicaa in the Valley of Wind, both of which feature lots of aeronautics in them, and Mad Max 2. Although I guess Mad Max Fury Road would be a better comparison, because it's like super violent. It's worth a look. Try and pick up the first issue if you can from Comixology, and if you like it, just devour it. It's great, and it has that really satisfying thing that properly violent, decent scale action stories have, where it doesn't matter that not every different potential character relationship plays out, or you get to spend loads of time with each of them. You know enough about them. None of them are completely shallow, but you find out everything you need to about them to get through this story. There is potential for a sequel, which would be nice, because everything isn't resolved by the end of it, but enough is that it just works as this perfect six-issue series. So anyway, that's me. Left to my own devices and standing up, I find that after a little bit of talking, I definitely need the toilet quite a lot. So I'm going to go to the toilet, listener. I hope you've had a good episode. I have found it nerve-wracking. Thanks, as always, to our contributors, Max and Peter. You're awesome. And thank you, listener. You're great. We'll see you next week. Hopefully talking to a couple of my podcasting siblings, spouses. Not really sure. James is definitely my podcasting wife. I'm not sure. I guess the Jesse podcasting little sister, niece. Is that weird? I don't know. Anyway.